All right, let's get rolling here. Good morning. Welcome to Flood Watch. I'm Tony Schick. I'm a editor at Oregon Public Broadcasting and a reporting fellow with ProPublica. I will be moderating this discussion. We've got Ed Clark with NOAA's National Water Center, Jesse Ritter from the National Wildlife Federation, and Mark Schleifstein from I have lost track of the names
the
now.
The Times-Picayune. The New Orleans Advocate.
Thank you. And we'll each present a little bit here, and then we'll open it up for discussion. Ed, why don't you get us started?
All right. Thank you, Tony, and thank you all for being here. I find that there are two types of people who can speak into microphones, those that either grew up in the church or those that perform a lot of karaoke. I do neither, so I'm going to tend to drift back and away. So if you can't hear me, remind me to get closer to the mic. So as Tony said, my name is Ed Clark. I'm the director of the National Water Center. We're NOAA's newest facility, part of the National Weather Service, located in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. For the sake of full disclosure, we were directed appropriation by the former chair of the Appropriations Committee, Senator Shelby. That's why we're in his backyard. But we are a necessary component of the evolution and transformation of our flood information, water resources information across the NOAA landscape. So why don't you go to the next slide. When we began this journey to fundamentally disrupt the hydrology program in the National Weather Service, we went out and asked stakeholders at river basin commissions around the country, fundamentally, what keeps you up at night? And the things that they told us were, it's not just floods, it's not drought, but it's too much water, too little water, water of poor quality, and water in locations where it is unusable or not useful. They also told us that they needed information to spatial and temporal resolutions at which they were solving problems. And so one of the emerging technologies that we leveraged the opportunity to build a National Water Center was allowed us to build something we call the National Water Model. I was pleased to see that in Mark's slides he has this as a tool that's available to the journalist community as well as the American public that really provides this comprehensive set of information. If you look at the image on the left, you see the blue lines. Those are where the traditional river forecast centers, which there are 13 in this country, provide a river forecast. It's about 110,000 miles, primarily downstream of locations where the U.S. Geological Survey operates a stream gauge. By contrast, the image on the left shows the red lines. Those are individual vector lines that represent the hydrography of the nation, including both the saltwater and brackish water, as well as freshwater tributaries across the country. That represents 3.4 million miles of rivers. It includes Hawaii, Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and when we release version 3.0 later this year, we will extend to portions of Alaska, truly making it a national capability. And the reason I mention this is that one of the challenges we face in this nation is tied to equity in terms of social, economic justice, environmental justice. Our U.S. Geological Survey friends do a tremendous job, but only about one-third of the gauges that are located in this country are fully funded by appropriations. The other two-thirds of the gauges require community investment. So if you're a community of lower socioeconomic status, challenged with resources, you probably don't have a gauge in your area. By contrast, you do get a forecast from the National Water Model, truly making it a national capability. Let's go to the next slide, because this is the basis for how we're evolving and transforming information.
It's a really cool animation on the right. If you can't get to work, but we will distribute a link later on. Yeah.
I also have one set to salsa music, if that's more your jam. So the reason I mention this, this is the basis for a new capability that we call real-time and forecast flood inundation maps. We're essentially taking a very simple concept, water on a map, placing it in people's backyards, allowing an effective response to a rather ethereal challenge or risk that up till now has been introduced either as a regulatory product, the flood insurance rate maps that are provided by FEMA, or something that's tied to the hydrograph, a time series at a gauge location that we then extrapolate impacts from. This, by contrast, puts the water on a map in somebody's backyard. Let's go to the next slide, please. We'll see this in more detail. So the water model combined with this flood mapping capability really illustrates and shows where the impacts in real time, based on the forecast of actual weather, where the impacts will be, both pluvial and fluvial processes. We began this journey in 2017 with the release of prototype information for Hurricane Harvey. We are culminating it by 2026 with full coverage for the entirety of the U.S. This year, the first 10% will be released to the American public. This will change how we understand flooding and flood risk across the spectrum of the services that the National Weather Service provide. And we hope, in partnership with the media and the public sector and private sector journalists, really tell a story that is much more compelling for those that need to take proactive action to protect their life, save property, and enhance the nation's economy. Go to the next slide, please. And this is just a timeline of that rollout. It began with our Summer Institute, where we work with students across the country, universities that are associated with a consortium of universities for the advancement of hydrologic sciences. That's a six-letter acronym. We love acronyms in NOAA. But it's truly represented an infusion of new thoughts, new ideas. The FIM, this new capability, was born out of that Summer Institute, very rapidly prototyped, and within 10 years brought to true operations within our agency. I'd like to shift gears and talk a little bit about, pardon me while I grab a sip of water. I grew up in Salt Lake, so I should be used to the drier climate here, but my gosh, spending time in the Deep South, it's almost like you grow gills. Go to the next slide, please. So there's a few other opportunities that are out there, changing how we're providing new and improved information to the American public. Recently passed last December, was the Floods Act, a Flood Level Observing Operations and Decision Support Act of 2022. There are multiple sections in this piece of legislation, and I'll point out four or five transformational ones. The first is the parallel to what many of you may be familiar with is called the National Integrated Drought Information System. We are now authorized and directed to produce a National Integrated Flood Information System. Observations for total water prediction. This deals with comprehensive water information along the coast. Section 12, which I'll talk in more detail, provides the opportunity for NOAA to establish a program to routinely produce flood frequency. You may know of this as Atlas 14, which is the annual exceedance probabilities for different rainfall events. You hear 100-year storm, 100-year rainfall, 1,000-year rainfall. Just last week, we saw a 1 in 1,000 percent annual chance of occurrence for the rainfall that occurred outside of Fort Lauderdale. This is how we characterize the changing risk. So establishing a program and leveraging bipartisan infrastructure law resources to get a head start on this, we are modernizing precip frequency across the nation for communities across all of the area that the National Weather Service serves, including outlying territories and Oconus regions. I'm really excited about Section 14, the establishment of a hydrologic research fellowship program. The law here directs us to partner with historically minority-serving colleges and institutions. And I say this because our workforce today, NOAA, looks a lot like me, white, male, not diverse, not reflection of the nation of which we are designed to serve. Working through the fellowship program and infusing new scientists and engineers into the community will allow us to develop a workforce that is absolutely essential to the risks that we face in the 21st century, from flooding, from drought, from all manner of water resources-related activities. And finally, passed last year was the Precipitation Act, or PRECIP Act. This is a little bit more abstract, but it directs us to, again, look at the precip frequency work, but this time the problem of maximum precipitation studies. All of these go into characterizing flood risk for the design, construction, and build of engineered environments. Let's go to the next slide, please. I want to talk a little bit about the bipartisan infrastructure law, because this is a once-in-a-generational infusion of resources into this agency. You can read the language here on the screen, but $492 million was dedicated to coastal and freshwater inundation, the application of a next-generation water resources prediction model, and a modernized precip frequency, including problem maximum precip. This, as I said, provides the first ever generational change in water information to the federal agencies, to NOAA. We're working not only across Weather Service, but across the National Ocean Service, our Office of Oceanic Atmospheric Research, our satellite group, NESDAS, National Environmental Satellite and Data Integrated Service and Information Service, and our Office of Marine and Aircraft Observations. So truly a comprehensive set of tools and techniques that are coming from this critical investment at this critical time. Next slide, please. And this just shows some of the various activities under BIL. You see down here on the bottom left, coastal and freshwater inundation mapping, collection of LIDAR and bathymetric information in areas that have not been collected since the 1950s. The James River through Richmond has not had a bathymetric survey done since 1957. It's a critical piece of our nation's navigation, as well as an area where subsidence, a change in sea level rise, is impacting everything from Hampton Roads all the way up into the Richmond region. You see frequency here on the left. Milled here, we see the advancements in the water model tied to the mapping. And finally, the top is another example of the inundation maps that will, I contend, fundamentally transform how we do services for floods that are developed to be designed through what we call our service delivery model. This is a continuous integration of information and customer feedback to enhance our predictive capabilities. Go to the last slide, please. This is Atlas 14. Is there, just by a show of hands, is anybody familiar with this product? Most engineers are. I think sometimes some folks in the media use this as a way to contextualize or characterize the relative rarity of events. We certainly saw this last week in Fort Lauderdale where, while it was not a widespread event, it certainly was an extreme event in terms of the exceedance of that 1 in 1,000 chance rainfall events over portions of Fort Lauderdale, leading to flood waters that have lasted now for days, stretching into weeks. Atlas 14 will be updated in with these resources to include the impacts of climate change. So that for the first time ever, not just taking a statistical look or snapshot of what the observations tell us, but applying the climate scale models from the IPCC reports over the last 20 years and projecting that out into what we can anticipate going forward with a changing and warming climate. And then finally, probable maximum precip. Again, used to design the most critical of infrastructure that cannot fail. Nuclear plants, large-scale dams, things that, if they fail, have catastrophic impacts on society. Let's go to the last slide, please. The final thing I want to just mention briefly, because it's unique to our situation, is that we've established a cooperative institute with a consortium of universities, including many across the western U.S., the interior portion of the country, and the East Coast, to train the next generation of water resources scientists and engineers. This will invest in four thematic areas, including the applications of social, behavioral, and economic sciences to what has traditionally been a physical science-based field. CAIRO, or the Cooperative Institute for Research Operations and Hydrology, is an unprecedented opportunity for us to work with the academic sector to infuse new science and research and understand the contextualization of that by leveraging social and economic science as well as a physical scientist. I think with that, Tony, that's my last slide. I'm looking forward to taking questions.
All right. We'll pass it over to Jesse, who will talk a little bit about the policy and challenges of.
Thank you. Good morning. Thanks, everyone, for waking up early on a Saturday to talk about flooding. I'm Jesse Ritter. I'm the Associate VP for Water and Coasts at the National Wildlife Federation. You can go to the next slide. For those who might not be familiar with NWF, we are the nation's oldest conservation organization. What makes us a federation is that we work with a network of 52 state and territorial affiliate organizations all around the country. And those independent organizations are part of our federation, help set our policy agenda, and also are usually our first partners on the ground when we're working, you know, in various on-the-ground projects and campaigns around the country. Next slide, please. So the idea that I wanted to talk a little bit about this morning is sort of this unique moment that we're at when it comes to floodplain management. So obviously, we're all very well aware that we're in a setting where we have increased and growing disaster risk. This past year, 2022, was, by NOAA's estimates, I believe, tied for the third costliest year in terms of natural disasters, the most expensive of which last year, of the billion-dollar disasters, was Hurricane Ian, and often we find our flooding events are our most expensive events, and certainly loss of life very high. So You know, this is the trajectory we're on. This is the trajectory we will be on. At the same time, we have this moment right now where we have this immense influx of, you know, new resources and federal dollars to support resilience outcomes, both in terms of on-the-ground projects, including at agencies that we haven't necessarily always looked to for resilience projects, places like the Department of Transportation, for example, as well as the science. You know, Ed talked about some of the exciting resources to improve our forecasting capabilities. So that's this really exciting development that we want to maximize and take advantage of. And then there's this third component, which I feel like is probably the piece that's gotten the least attention, and that is that we're facing this confluence of upcoming federal agency rulemakings right now that have really significant implications for our floodplains. And not all of them necessarily like look like they're floodplain rules on their face, but they are, and they really have impacts on floodplains, floodplain wetlands, and resources. And they're either kind of, you know, they're recently finalized or forthcoming down the pipeline in the next couple of years. And so that's a really important space to watch because it's going to provide this framework for future decision making around floodplain management. So taken collectively, you know, kind of looking at this moment, the question is really, in my view, you know, how do we maximize, you know, the additive benefits of how we deploy these resources and implement these rules, and at the same time prevent a situation where we maybe have one arm of the federal family doing something that is contrary to the resilience objectives or policies or goals of another. Next slide. So an important part of this discussion around floodplain management is really the role of natural floodplains and natural floodplain functions, not only for flood mitigation, but obviously also for the many other values and services they provide to society. And those benefits are, you know, increasingly being recognized. I think really starting in the late 1960s, we had this growing national recognition that natural resource management was really related to floodplain management, was really related to disaster management and disaster assistance, and that we needed an integrated approach to addressing these issues. And so it was around that time that this concept of having a federal goal to have a united or integrated floodplain management approach really took hold. And in 1975, Congress first authorized the Federal Interagency Floodplain Management Task Force, or the FIFMTIF, which is one of my favorite acronyms, to prepare recommendations for Congress on how to implement a unified federal, you know, floodplain management program, the dual objectives of which would be to reduce loss of life and reduce property damage, and at the same time, preserve and restore the natural resources and functions of our floodplains. So that happens in 1975. Shortly thereafter, there are a series of executive orders which go on to direct the agencies to take actions to reduce the risk of flood loss and to preserve the natural and beneficial functions of floodplains. We had our wetlands executive order, which directed agencies to minimize the degradation of wetlands. More recently, in 2015, the Federal Flood Risk Management Standard, which some of you may be familiar with, was rescinded during the Trump administration and then reinstated in 2021. But there's kind of this, you know, longstanding recognition of the importance of these objectives, right? And yet here we are, and here we sit today in 2023, and we still are devoid of any unified national strategy or agenda. And part of the reason for that isn't that the FIFMTIF didn't do what they were told to do, but just because there's been inconsistent funding for their work and consistent, you know, federal commitment to this topic and this issue. So it's kind of ebbed and flowed, the attention to this. You know, in the meantime, certainly individual agencies have made a lot of progress along these objectives. And we can talk more about that, too, during the Q&A if that's of interest. But next slide here. But because of that lack of a coordinated strategy, I think it really underscores and makes all the more important this moment we're in, where we have some, you know, ongoing federal conversations around rulemakings. So just to a very high level spotlight a few things that are relevant here. The first is the EPA's Waters of the U.S. Jurisdictional decision and discussion. Those of you that are tracking this know this issue is one that has just ping-ponged around for quite some time now. The latest developments are that in December of 2022, EPA published a revised definition of WOTUS, Waters of the U.S., that largely sends us back to the status quo we were at pre-2015, pre the Obama Clean Water Rule, kind of puts us back to that status quo that had existed for a long time across, you know, administrations of different parties. At the same time, however, this is playing out in the courts. And so right now, that new rule from the Biden administration is halted in 26 states. And we're awaiting a Supreme Court decision in the Sackett versus EPA case that will have really significant potential ramifications for what waters are considered jurisdictional under the Clean Water Act, and could send, you know, EPA back to the drawing board again, depending on the outcome. So obviously, it impacts wetlands, impacts waterways, impacts floodplains and floodplain resilience. The second one to spotlight is that FEMA, it has signaled that they are interested in taking on an update to their minimum floodplain management standards. And so this really started with a request, a petition from the Association of State Floodplain Managers and Natural Resources Defense Council, which led to a request for information in 2021 from FEMA asking just for input about, okay, if we're going to update these standards, they haven't been updated since the very early 70s. So a long time. And by law, they're supposed to be updating them regularly. They asked the public for what they should be thinking about. That comment period obviously closed a while ago now, and we understand that they still intend to take this rulemaking on during the first term of the Biden administration, so we should be seeing that. That, you know, especially since they haven't been updated in decades, it's a really important moment for, you know, us to hopefully be pushing for better standards for resilience and really updated minimum criteria that steer risky development out of harm's way. So that's another issue to watch. And then lastly, the Army Corps of Engineers is updating their water resource planning guidelines, something in a whole mouthful of policy wonkiness called the Principles, Requirements, and Guidelines and the agency-specific procedures to implement the Principles, Requirements, and Guidelines. And so essentially, the implications of this, they have been, because of an appropriations rider, prohibited from actually moving forward with making this update to the water resource planning guidelines. This was originally directed in 2007, so it's been a long time coming now. It, in accordance with the National Water Resources Planning Policy, this update should really result in a few things. Maximizing our sustainable economic development, avoiding unwise use of floodplains, and accounting for and protecting the value of our ecosystem services. And so what we are hopeful to see is that this update to their planning guidelines will really ensure that the alternatives the Army Corps of Engineers is putting forward are fully evaluating the benefits and costs of ecosystem services, both lost and gained as a result of a project. But even before you get there, we hope that it actually drives the selection and evaluation of alternatives that do a better job of incorporating natural floodplain functions and natural infrastructure type solutions. And so we look forward to seeing what the Corps comes out with there. And I believe we could see that as early as this summer. And just one or two more quick slides. Lastly, I wanted to flag on the federal resources opportunity, in case this is a tool useful to you all as journalists. In December, National Wildlife Federation launched something we call our Nature-Based Funding Solutions Database. Our goal with this tool is sort of in recognition that we have so many programs across the federal family and a growing number, especially because of the bipartisan infrastructure law, that can support nature-based solutions. Not all of these are exclusively for nature-based solutions, but those aren't they are an eligible project type. And so we wanted to develop a tool to help communities navigate this confusing and complex, you know, federal funding landscape. One more slide. And it is a searchable tool. And so our goal was to develop something that has filters that allows individual community members or, you know, community planners to filter by project purpose, as well as other types of critical information, like is there a cost share requirement? Is there cost share flexibility, perhaps? We also incorporated programs that are really about capacity building and technical assistance, knowing that that is such a significant need for many communities who are looking to access these funding opportunities right now. So wanted to put that on your radar in case that is of interest to you. We are striving to keep it updated, and we are also very welcoming of feedback on it, as it's, you know, a living tool for us and something that we want to be as useful as possible. So with that, thank you and look forward to discussion.
So I'm going to be the reporter geek here and talk about tools that you can use in your reporting. And as you're doing these stories, let's see, can you go to the next slide? Remember who we're doing this for. We're doing this for the people who are directly at risk of flooding and need to know in advance of when something like this happens that they're at risk. So that's always important to know. Next slide. Okay, so one of the things that we have to worry about is risk rating 2.0. Let's see. I'll tell you what. Let me back out of this and get to my slideshow and do this properly. Okay. Okay. So risk rating 2.0 is this new way that the National Flood Insurance Program is determining how people will be charged for flood insurance. And there are many people in my state who feel that it is discriminatory and that it is not working. And one of the major reasons for that is a phrase that Louisiana uses, which is that we are a working coast. We have people who live outside levee systems who have to live there. And this new system is basically pricing them out. And it's a real problem that they're having to deal with. And it's been a real problem attempting to find out exactly how they're coming up with the costs that they're charging people. So that's a potential thing for you to look at. At the same time, FEMA has done a really good job of explaining risk with this National Risk Index that really does attempt to look at how well or how bad things are. And if you just do, as I'm going through these, if you just do a Google search on what I have at the bottom, you're generally going to find it. But I also have a Google Doc version of this that I'll make available to you. So this National Risk Index is you can drill down and find out for your county what your risk is and why that risk exists. Remember that there are other horses in the room when you're talking about risk rating 2.0. Our congressional delegation has a lot to say about it. So do our state and local officials. And there are other organizations that provide you with an opportunity to get their views on it, National Association of Realtors. Another good place to look for information about risk rating 2.0 and just about any other issue involving flooding is the Congressional Research Service and the Government Accountability Office. They have a variety of different documents, studies that they have done that keep up to date with how things are going through Congress and what the issues are that are facing those programs. And then there are other organizations as well that also are dealing with these kinds of issues. So we heard from the Office of Water Prediction. The National Water Model is available for you to take a look at. As you heard, I will tell you that we had a very good example of what happens when before what they started doing occurred, what happens when the public does not understand where water occurs. There's a community called Laplace that is on the west, to the west of Lake Pontchartrain, very large lake. And during a hurricane, storm surge got pushed into the lake and into that community. The water gauges for that area were in the water. And so they showed dots on a map that said the water was this high, but it didn't show what the water would be in the community. And the community flooded significantly, and now there are color-coded maps that are being developed by the state, by the National Hurricane Center and others to better understand what the risk is to the public for things like that. Again, going back to the water prediction model, here's an example here in town of some of the information you can get from that. The other thing that as we move into the BIL, IIJA funding, a variety of states are attempting to figure out how to tell the public what this money is going to be spent on. And Louisiana has developed this map, which provides you with an opportunity to look at a variety of different things, where projects are compared to disadvantaged areas, the gray areas, and the variety of different kinds of projects that are listed by color dot. And when you hit one of those dots, it will bring up a variety of information, detailed information about the projects that are being funded. My assumption is that other states will be doing this, but Louisiana has done a pretty good job of understanding that the public needs to know a little bit more about this. Another major tool that you guys should be using is the National Levy Database. A database that is put together by the Army Corps of Engineers. The Corps is expanding it to include both levy systems that are funded by through the Army Corps of Engineers, but they're also attempting to capture private and non-federal levies as well. And you can see how many levies there are. You'd never guess that some of these levies are in places there are. My favorite is that there's a levy on in Washington, D.C., on the National Mall.
Yeah.
And nobody knew about it, and they had to build it higher because it was not high enough several years ago. The good thing about this system is that you can figure out quite a bit of information about what's going on. Again, I used an Idaho levy as an example, but you can use any one that you want. And the thing to remember about this is that the Corps of Engineers actually uses this database to give you estimates of what the risk is for individual pieces of the levy system, and it's not what you would think it is. In many cases, they have come up with a risk estimate that is based on the potential for a worst-case scenario and what the dollars are behind it. So, for instance, New Orleans levies are high risk, even though they are the best new levies in the United States. And the reason they're high risk, which is the second worst rating, is because there's close to $200 billion worth of investment behind those levies that would flood when a storm surge hits the area that is greater than what the levies are designed to protect from. In New Orleans, those levies are designed to the so-called 100-year level, which is really a 1% chance of being overtopped in any year. And the way to explain that to the public is that there's a 26% chance of that occurring within the lifetime of your 30-year mortgage. Okay? So that, all of a sudden, you go, well, wait a minute. That's that's rather risky. How come the levies are that low? And that you'll find out quite a bit of information when you get into that database. One of the other things that flooding areas find out about in the worst way is that in many cases, after a storm, people actually need to find ways of getting rid of the water, and there actually have been teams created by the Army Corps of Engineers to do that. They're called, the Corps has this way of making up words that don't mean anything. It's an unwatering team. and they came into New Orleans and put in a series of pumps immediately after Katrina to pump the city, pump out about 200 billion gallons of water from the city of New Orleans. So it's pretty interesting. This is mostly for the coast. I'm not sure if NOAA is going to expand this to other areas, but, well, it has done some with Nashville tornadoes. But after hurricanes, NOAA sends a team out to do aerial surveys, and you can find those photos on this emergency response imagery database, which can prove to be pretty useful. They usually do this a couple of days after a hurricane or a major storm. And this is an example of what it looks like. This is for Laura, where this basically shows the areas that they went over. And this is an example of drilling down into that to see what they took pictures of. The actual pictures, you have to go get them. They're TIFFs, so they're big files. But you can either use these and lighten them up directly from, which are smaller files, or just go get the TIFFs. But it's very useful. Some people that would be useful for you to talk to and ways to find people here. NOAA has a staff directory. If you know who you're looking for, have a last name, use the staff directory and you can find out their contact information. I put this together because of for my reporters who cover hurricanes. There are also regional river forecast centers. And I'll point out that SciLine can provide you with scientists and engineers who can address key issues on deadline for you within a couple hours of when you call them. And Louisiana has an organization at Louisiana State University that is putting up coastal risk maps, and they're using information from storm surge and modeling and combining it with rainfall modeling to address how high water is in that area that I was talking about in La Place. It's one of those things they're working with you guys as well on that, I know. Another thing I would urge your newsrooms to do is find someone who can subscribe to NWS Chat. And I don't know if you're familiar with NWS Chat, but it's a program that was set up by the National Weather Service mainly for TV meteorologists and for emergency managers. It provides a direct connection to the National Weather Service local offices. And you can go on there and they will be talking about their forecasts as they are doing them or just before they do them with some basic information about what's going on. And the emergency managers will also inform the local offices of things that they have seen during storms. So it's a good way of capturing information about it. I tell people, try not to ask many questions on it because these forecasters don't have time to deal with you. But it's useful to do. The National Weather Service used to not let print reporters onto this service, but after Katrina, I sort of hit up the then National Weather Service Director, Usolini, and he agreed that it was time to expand it and let us do it. So something to think about. This is what one of their forecast pages look like, and you can see their advisories go up here before they go up on the web or at the same time they go up on the web. It's an easy way of finding out stuff. Another good thing, again, a geek thing, is to have the National Weather Service glossary available for you because, as I know only too well, I have to turn to the glossary almost every time I'm on NWS chat because the forecasters are talking National Weather Service geek, and you have to figure out what the heck they're meaning. The other key forecast offices that you guys should all be connected to are the river forecast centers that are providing basic information about rainfall and how rainfall is affecting local offices, local areas. And here's an example of this area, and all the different dots are different locations where they are watching observe precipitation and water heights and things like that. Another interesting thing to use is NASA WorldView, which is satellite photos for your area, which is a pretty good way of getting this information in a form that you can use because they're federally, you know, they're pictures that you can reprint. I can tell you that Google Earth also allows you to reprint their pictures, and I use them all the time to look locally at different things. And Google Earth also has a time delay system, so you can go back in some areas and follow changes in how things looked over time, which is can be also very useful. National Hurricane Center has their forecasts. Again, I just threw this in to cover all the bases. And I always start out with National Weather Service, National Hurricane Center, to find, come on, Mark, satellite photos, because I find their satellite photos to be better and easier to get. You can fiddle around with it in such a way to get photos that are not just coastal, but are throughout the United States. And, of course, you can use them for hurricanes in various different ways, in various different colors to show different the way storms work. And that's a good example. This was Hurricane Laura before it went ashore. Something like that on your front page tells your readers that they should get out. Another neat thing is Mike's weather page. That's spaghettimodels.com. Mike is just a guy who, he really is. He's just this guy who glommed on weather stuff, and he has put together this big, long page of various different sources that you can use to find out stuff about weather. And I'm going to stop there. If you want my Google Doc, which has the addresses, please send me an email and I'll send you the Google Doc.
We'll open it up for questions in a minute. I was hoping first to start with if you could talk a little bit about how some of these can how reporters can make some connections between what we've just heard. So if I'm looking into the state of levees, how might I use some of the water model tools, or if how might I use some of those other tools, or some of the science that Ed was talking about to watchdog some of the policies that Jesse mentioned, things like that.
Well, for individual levee systems, you should probably start with the Corps of Engineers and their database first to figure out how they are determining how high that levee is and what the standards are. And then for the water center, they'll provide you with, you know, hopefully as we move forward with their development of their database, they'll provide you with information about how high water is in some of those areas. You know, we have, I will tell you an interesting one for us was back in 2020, we had the potential for a hurricane to form, Hurricane Barry, and it sort of moved around on the coast in interior before it finally made its way into the Gulf of Mexico. It was at a time when the National Weather Service, the River Center, was forecasting high river in New Orleans, and the river was at 20 feet in New Orleans. Now, the official flood level for New Orleans is 17 feet, but flood walls and levees protect it to 25 feet. But one of the problems that was found during Hurricane Katrina is that a hurricane can actually push water upriver, storm surge, that will be on top of that water that is flowing downriver. And so one of the concerns was that the day before the storm formed, there were concerns that the storm would form to the east of the river and its storm surge would be more than 5 feet, and we might have the most unusual kind of flood that no one had seen since the 1700s, which was the French Quarter flooding from the river. And so that's why it's good for you to understand all the different things of how a river works in your area and what, you know, all the different tools you can use to find out what the risk is.
Yeah, that's, I think Mark was spot on. The story is what communities are impacted by the infrastructure, whether it's protected or not protected. And then the real-time intelligence is the forecast, where what the water level will be, what it is today, what it may go to. And then the value add there is the conversations with the forecasters about the unusual context here. Barry was a great example of kind of the worst case scenario of targeting a very small target, the mouth of the Mississippi River, with a relatively big hurricane that could push that water in there. And that nuance is lost without looking at contextualizing the levee systems, but also talking with the forecasters. So the relationships to the RFC, to weather forecast office, to local emergency managers, it's all kind of, there's a story there, and I think most people find that relatively fascinating. from a policy perspective? No, go ahead.
I mean, I'm so excited about a lot of the tools that Ed talked about, and I do wonder how much they're really making their way out, you know, to the public. I think to some extent that's happening, but I think the more we can continue to amplify and push those tools out, because they can and they should be informing our investment decisions in the context of all of these new dollars. A lot of this money is going to be decided and driven at the state or local level. Certainly there are programs, you know, where you're applying for competitive dollars from the feds, but a lot of these big buckets are going to be driven at the state and local level through formula programs and otherwise. And so making sure these communities actually understand their true risk. And then just a related point is the reality that our flood insurance rate maps, FEMA's maps that they produce to represent the 1%, you know, annual chance of flooding or 100-year floodplain, we know in most parts of the country remain incredibly outdated. They're not truly representative of the current 100-year floodplain, nor are they reflective of, you know, the changing risk due to climate change. And so, you know, that's something FEMA continues to work to update. We also, you know, understand that there's interagency discussions to try to integrate all of these important data sets NOAA's producing and working on. But where we have that information available through these other tools, really getting that in the hands of communities as soon as possible, I think, is going to be the way to ensure that we have smart investments of all of these dollars.
All right, we've got just under half an hour for questions. I'll remind you, please identify yourselves, and there's a Q&A policy here that reminds me to tell you no speeches. We're looking for questions. This is not an opportunity to display your oratorial splendor. So I embellished. Any questions?
Your hand was up first here. I'll bring a mic since they're recording.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Hi, thank you for this. My name's Haley Smith. I'm a reporter with the LA Times. We had a very flood-filled winter in California this year, and one of the issues that we were running up against was that a lot of the levees that we saw breaching were managed by these tiny reclamation districts that didn't seem to have oversight or budgets. And I'm wondering, are those included in that national levee database? And if not, are there any tools that we can use to maybe help us monitor those kinds of levees? Because that's where we saw the most destruction.
They are in the national levee database. In fact, I looked them up when those floods occurred. And of course, Sacramento levee is there. And of course, that levee system is one step above high risk. It's the worst. And the reason for that is I've been on that levee and it's made out of dust. I mean, it's really horrible stuff. One of the things to remember about a lot of these levees is that they were built a generation ago with standards that were in place then, and standards changed dramatically after Hurricane Katrina, and the standards that are in place today call for levees to be built completely with a quality clay as opposed to being filled with organic dirt or just plain dirt and then covered with clay. So that's one of the things that you can look at when you're looking at the risk in your area. The other thing, again, because of the way the Corps of Engineers does its determination, some of those areas that flooded this time were not even at the high risk level. They were lower. But the reason for that is because they were farm communities or small towns that did not have much value being protected by those levees. And so that's one of the problems that I see with that system.
Other questions?
Hi, I'm Erica Guise. I'm an independent reporter and also the author of Water Always Wins, Thriving in an Age of Drought and Deluge. Oh, thank you. It's really about people around the world who are taking nature-based solutions to scale. So I've been intrigued by the Biden administration's touting the infrastructure law and the IRA as having X billions for nature-based solutions. But when you read the fine print, you know, nature-based solutions are one option of what this money can go to. So it's sort of overstating it. And I'm curious, probably this question is for Jesse, with your database. Like, my impression from interviewing people is that a lot of decision makers and engineers think that nature-based solutions are nice, but they can't be a significant part of the solution because they don't really understand the scale. So if it's just one option and if people don't have good knowledge about their efficacy, if they haven't looked at the science, what are you finding in terms of communities' knowledge and, interest in these types of, use of the funding mechanism from these bills?
Yeah. That's a good question. I would say the general trend we're seeing is more and more communities are curious about these solutions. I think there's a continuum, of folks that are just not even aware that's an option because, and a lot of it's the atmospherics, right? If you're in a community where the default is, let's build a seawall and a living shoreline isn't even on the menu that your local contractor is offering when you need a, erosion solution, You're not going to, the average person may not even think to explore, right, that option. But I think, I would say it's just, it's been a slow and steady infiltration of this concept over time. And increasingly the communities we're talking to on the ground and working with are curious about them. The next, you know, kind of step on that continuum though, is, are they harder to do? Is it actually that we have policy barriers that, you know, maybe a community is curious, they start exploring that option and then they hit some barrier and they go, oh, permitting is going to take longer. Or, oh, actually, you know, the contractors aren't here to help me with this. Or the benefit cost analysis is challenging and I can't get this project through. And so I think that what we're starting to see addressed now, which is great, is that next kind of step, which is, can we remove these barriers? And then there's the ongoing need for the continuing monitoring and, you know, verification and reporting. There's also been a lot of progress in this space as well. And, you know, I mean, many of you are probably familiar with for example, the Army Corps of Engineers Engineering with Nature program. They have proving grounds around the country now that are really trying to, you know, show engineers across the districts that these solutions can work. Here's how you can design them successfully. And so I think we're making a lot of progress on a lot of fronts. It isn't, you know, kind of one even wave. It's happening sort of, the infiltration is kind of happening slowly, but I think it is happening. And we do see and sense this increased demand, which was, again, part of the reason for this database.
In terms of the cost benefit analysis piece of it, you know, in the dominant economic system, of course, like all of these benefits aren't counted, right? You're counting the one thing, like, is it going to prevent flooding? And you're not counting against it all of the complex systems that you're harming and doing that.
Right.
Are you seeing any movement toward addressing that issue?
Yes, and really, actually, really exciting movement. So just last week or the week prior, the Office of Management and Budget put out an update to their A4 circular and their A94 circulars, which basically are the circulars that help provide guidance to the agencies for how you do a benefit cost analysis for a regulation or for a project. And they did a couple of things in those circulars, one of which was actually lowering the discount rate applied. The discount rate is frequently cited as an inhibitor for nature-based solutions moving forward, since they are not often strongest on the first day they're built. They actually grow in their strength and effectiveness over time. And they, in that guidance, are also, you know, kind of explicitly telling agencies to look at some of these other social and environmental benefits. There's also independent work that the Army Corps is doing to evaluate how we can do a better job with ecological and social benefits and costs. So good progress on many fronts. And I can talk about this for a long time if you want to follow up. There's a lot more to say.
Other questions? Yeah.
I'm Michael Warren with NJ Spotlight News in New Jersey, and this is kind of a logistics question for you, Ed. The water model looks really cool. I'm excited to use it. Where will it be? Is it something that we're going to be able to access easily? And I think your slide mentioned that this year the first 10% is going to be rolled out. What part of the country is going to be covered by that 10%?
Yeah, you can go to water.noaa.gov to get the water model itself. It's also available. Retrospective data sets have been placed up on the Amazon S3 buckets. So if you're a data geek and you have people on your team that want to go back and build retrospective analyses of the last 25 years or so of data, that certainly is an option. And then there will be two locations for the first 10%. Areas around the Gulf Coast, primarily centered on the Dallas-Fort Worth, Houston, Lake Charles Weather Forecast Office, kind of that Texas Hill Country area, Corpus Christi, I think, is in there too, and San Angelo, and then the Northeast. So Albany, Binghamton, Buffalo, State College, Pennsylvania. I don't think Mount Holly will be there first, but those data will be the first areas. It's actually running everywhere in the country. What the staggered approach to placing this online in the public view is not as much about the technical scaling. It's about the training and education, both internally and externally. So you may see these pop up in other locations, like, for example, in California. We partnered with FEMA this year as they were in the midst of the flood fight across the Central Valley. So it can't hurt to ask. Particularly those local offices, and you can always reach us at the Water Center. But those data services will be out. They'll be through RESTful APIs, but there's also weather.gov, the National Water Prediction Service webpage, will be updated in the January timeframe to reflect those services as well, make it a little bit more consumable.
Yes. Hi, I'm Najifa. I'm a student at the University of Montana. I think my question, I don't know who is best appropriate for Ed or Mark, either if you can answer it. So I think as per my understanding, all the tools that we saw, either it's about like a post-flood tracking situation or a flood when it's approaching. But my question was that is there any tool or organization who put like analyzes or tracks the sources of flood? It's like it can be natural resource like sea level rise or snowpack melting, or even like man-made infrastructure like dams. Like, is there any tool to get the source of it?
So when we talk about our flood warnings, it is holistic. So we talk about the causative event being, or the models that we run are continuous. So they represent the snowpack, the rainfall events. In the event of infrastructural failure, the water surface elevation in those situations will be attributed to some sort of anthropogenic process, man-made failure, dam failure, levee failure. It's not a database per se, but an event-by-event basis that are described in the warning itself or the product. And then for most of the large-scale events across the country, we do things called after-action reports or service assessments, and those are published on the Weather Service's webpage. So what happened during Hurricane Ian, for example, what happened during Hurricane Ida, what happened during Hurricane Katrina, we do go back and look at a retrospective analysis of what was the cause of the flooding. You know, when was it complicated or exacerbated by anthropogenic failures? What were the snowpack conditions? For example, the Missouri floods of 2011. They're all kind of the story is told and documented in a way that we can learn from our own challenges, but also understanding kind of the causative effects.
Hi, I'm Louise Lee, founder of the Science and the Media Project. Ed, you had all those fantastic tools, but looking at them, it looks like it would be very hard for ordinary people to access them or understand them, and communities, especially the communities, marginalized communities, to make any sense out of that. I'm wondering if you have a plan or a portal so that people who don't necessarily know all the science can access all that great actionable intelligence and advanced information so that they can take action, because now it looks a little bit inaccessible.
Yeah, that's a great question. So there are two answers to that. First, we have a lot to learn about this, providing information, leveraging our cooperative institute, which is with 26 different universities led by the University of Alabama, but also includes QASI, the Consortium of Universities for the Advancement of Hydrologic Sciences Incorporated, Research Triangle Institute. One of the themes is the applications of social, behavioral, and economic sciences to help us better tune our tools and deliver the services in a way that lowers the bar for use by the communities. The second piece of that is, as I mentioned, a parallel to the actual data services that will be launched in September, the National Water Prediction Service, a replacement to the Advanced Hydrologic Prediction Service, will go live somewhere in the January timeframe. That webpage is geared at creating a user experience that is much, much more accessible than, say, things like water.noaa.gov or dealing with a .NET CDF file or worrying about the nuances of downloading a RESTful API map layer that's dynamically updating. It's, with all due respect, it's designed at the curious user, not the super user. That's a tricky question because we are limited by the user. The federal government is limited by the information that we can collect on the user. To the extent that people self-report, hey, when using this webpage, I found this challenge or I don't understand this, we can certainly document that. What we don't do is we can't track at the IP address level of how long somebody comes to a web page, what they look at, how frequently they look at it. That is all, we're all prohibited from doing those types of deep analytics that, a commercial sector might be able to do.
So how would you know if it's working or not?
Hopefully we hear about people making decisions. And that's where I think the best conduit for that is not relying on the infrastructure that we operate, but it's having the stories in the media, making sure that we understand how the press is reporting on successes and the challenges. I look at this as a partnership. We're not going to be successful. We, the Westerners, we, the government, are not going to be successful on our own trying to put tools out there and say, well, why didn't you use it? We have to create a relationship and a commitment to have these types of conversations. And it's not just me. It's all the colleagues of mine at the 122 weather forecast offices, the 13 river forecast centers, other line offices within NOAA, our academic partners, groups like the Nurture Nature Foundation, who we've worked with in the past, to better understand from their perspective and the perspectives of the end user in the communities, how are they using things as simple as a hydrograph? We take that for granted, but it's designed for hydrologists by hydrologists. It's not designed for, you know, an elementary school teacher to convey basic science questions to a sixth grader. It should be.
Can I also point out that Ken Graham, the head of the new head of the National Weather Service, has made a commitment to use social science to basically redo a number of forecast information products that would include flood, you know, warnings and watches and things like that. So something to think about.
Saw your hand first.
Thanks. Bryce Gray with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Two-part question, mostly for you, Ed. First, you know, we know, of course, about the well-documented inaccuracies of things like FEMA flood maps. I'm wondering, first of all, sort of, you know, what's going to be different or more trustworthy about some of those new you know, flood forecasting and mapping tools that you showed off. But then also I'm curious if, you know, besides informing, you know, a warning system like you described, is there ultimately an effort to try to marry that up with either, you know, improving the accuracy of FEMA flood maps or ultimately leading to changes in flood insurance or buyouts? You know, is NOAA going to do more, I guess, work with other agencies to, I guess, lead to any of those outcomes, I guess, at a policy level?
Well, it's a good thing nobody hears from the media that my words won't come back to bite me. the difference between what we're doing and what the FEMA flood hazard layer, we're not stopping at the 1% chance or 0.02% chance flood. We're looking at mapping the true extent of the water based on the causative event. So if 40-some-odd inches of rain falls in Houston, what does the mapping look like for that versus just the 500-year or, I'm sorry, the 0.2% annual occurrence or the 1% annual occurrence rate? That's the difference, because when you ask people, I'll ask this audience, who lives in a floodplain? Okay? All of us live in a floodplain. The folks whose hands went up probably live in a special flood hazard area. That's the described 1% or 0.02% chance. I happen to live 600 feet off the elevation of a creek. I'm probably not going to get flooded in my property per se, but that doesn't mean that I can't see the manifestation of adverse flooding in my community, in my home. That's the difference between a regulatory map and the real-time map, that we're not stopping at some pre-described level. Your question about changes in policy, and I think I'd actually like to hear from Jess about this at a more policy level, but there are – our senior scientist, Dr. Sarah Kapnick, has asked us, how can we have this capability that's tied to the here and now, the weather events, with what NOAA also knows and has expertise in, which is climate scale applications, the Climate Ready Nation initiative that COBEAR is leading. How do you relate those two, and is there an opportunity in the future to have better influence around the realms of the possible of flooding, flood change over time that can then go back and inform processes like the National Flood Hazard Layer? The last thing I'll say on that is I do participate on the Technical Mapping Advisory Council as NOAA's representative. These conversations are ongoing. Talked about it with the FIF and TIF. That is one of my also favorite acronyms. The FFRDS, or FFRD, the Future Flood Risk Definitions, and then the FFRMS, which just completed its update in 2021. Those conversations are going to be had at the policy level, and I think the changes that we're seeing are necessitating a drive to go beyond where we are today. I hope, and Jess, this is maybe where you can jump in, we should be hearing from this administration and future administrations about these executive orders and how they relate to these changes that are needed. I'm cautiously optimistic, but we're not going to get there from a one-size-fits-all solution. It's going to be an approach, and it will be, I think, it should be influenced by the input from the communities, not policy wonks, not federal agencies, but communities. And that's why what all of you do is so important, because that's how we hear about these stories. Stories move budgets on the Hill. Better data, you know, 70% accuracy rate, you know, 20% false alarm ratio doesn't do much. But telling a compelling story about a community that was able to take action. They moved vehicles during Harvey and saved one county in the Houston metro region, saved $7 million in high water vehicles because they had the inundation map. They knew where the water wasn't going to be. They moved their vehicles there. Had they left them in place, they would have been flooded and destroyed. Those stories make policy changes more susceptible, more possible. The other ones are about water supply. There's one reservoir in California in Sonoma County, Lake Mendocino. That area, I know this is about flooding, but that area has implemented something called forecast informed reservoir operations, leveraging a forecast tool with how they operate the dam. That dam, that forecast, on average has saved 8,000 to 10,000 acre feet a year. 8,000 to 10,000 acre feet of water per year has a cost of $27 to $32 million. One forecast, one dam. That's the type of story that we can tell together.
So the only thing I would add is that, so these are questions we've asked over time too, right? And it's like, we have this great information living in different places within the federal family. How are we kind of connecting the dots, and how does your average, you know, community planner know where to go for the best information, right? There have been kind of these iterations of interagency discussions, like I mentioned, some of which feel pretty dormant right now in case of the FIF and TIF. Right now there's interagency working groups separated by hazard, right, within the White House. So there's a flood group separate from the coastal group, separate from the wildfire group. And, you know, again, I don't know, sometimes it feels like artificial separations, but, you know, we got to get the work done somehow. There's also a new interagency group authorized in the Floods Act that you mentioned, right? And so how is that going to play out and play in here? And I think, you know, speaking from NWF's perspective, the important thing is less so which interagency group it is. It's that it's durable and lasting and not subject to the whims of different administrations, and that we can start to make some sustained progress on this unified federal approach to floodplain management. And so I think we're interested to see how, you know, kind of some of these newly authorized bodies play into the discussion and continue to just push for this cohesion within the federal family.
We are at time. We started a little late, so we have time for one more quick question, if anybody has a quick question. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Katie Myers. I'm a fellow with GRIST, but I just left a job with WMMT 88.7 FM, which is in rural eastern Kentucky. And we experienced some really severe flooding last year. And so I was, you know, I was looking at all these amazing maps and everything, and they're great, but they're all like, there's so much, you know, reliance on like online information distribution, and so much of our community out there doesn't have like access to reliable internet or cell service. And so you had situations where people were like not aware of the flooding until their house was being like carried away on the river. So I'm just wondering, like, what, you know, are the, like, what's, is there anything in the hopper for, you know, addressing these kinds of warning issues where people just like don't have access to that kind of information regularly? If that makes sense.
Yeah, I'll give you a real quick answer. Through the applications of social science, we need to learn more about how to do that. We've talked about, you know, can we get this information in the hands of kids in K-12 programs who then bring home through their families? That's an option. Can we leverage the infrastructure that's in rural Kentucky, whether it be, you know, your local power generator or your local co-op, paper maps available to people? It's hard to do with real-time information. I think one of the, particularly in Kentucky, the challenge, I think it almost necessitates us thinking about flooding and these types of extreme rainfall events the same way we think about a tsunami, right? And it floods. When the water is coming downstream, you go up. it's a radical shift from where we've been, but that event that we saw last year outside of Jackson on Hazard was not. It will not never happen again. Let's put it that way. It will happen someplace else, and we have to think differently about a warning that tells you water's coming down the creek isn't going to save someone's life. A warning that says, elevate yourself now, get out of the way. That may be how we think about this going forward. I thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for coming, and thank you to our panelists here.